How do you handle in-flight emergencies during training? How do you handle air traffic control communications in a busy airspace?
Welcome to the Aviation Mentors Podcast, the podcast that takes your dreams of flight and turns it into reality.
Sponsored by Strass Financial, financing your flight training.
For pilots, by pilots. I'm Brandon Martini, a commercial pilot and flight instructor.
And I'm Carson Vasquez, I'm a private pilot.
Whether you're a seasoned pilot or beginner with dreams of flight,
Aviation Mentors is your source for expert insights, industry trends, and inspiring stories.
So fasten your seatbelts and prepare for this incredible journey through the skies.
And stay connected with us on social media for exclusive content.
And visit our website at www.aviationmentors.com and let us be your co-pilot on this adventure. Welcome back, everybody, to another awesome and amazing episode of the Aviation Mentors Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. As you can see, if you're watching us on video, Carson and I are separate today. I am at my house and Carson is in the studio. And he's wondering, Brandon, why aren't you in the studio with me? Carson, aren't you wondering that?
You know, I wondered that when I woke up this morning to a text saying, either make your background pretty or go into the office and record, because I'm not going to be in the office. I'm going to be at home.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I don't know why, because it's, you know, a much shorter drive for Brandon than me. But whatever makes Brandon happy, we're cool with.
Thank you so much. And it's because I'm getting a new wine fridge delivered today that I've been waiting for a month. And Amazon just said, I'm going to deliver it to you today. I said, okay, perfect. Deliver it today.
They lost your last one in transit, right?
They did. Yeah. How do you lose a like 800-pound wine fridge? Don't really know.
It's like 7 feet tall. It's not a small wine fridge.
Fell off the back of a truck, I'm sure, into somebody's
loving
art. To someone's new Venmo account because they just sold it. All right. With all that being said, we are going to dive into probably a new series actually today. We're going to answer some more listener questions. See, look at this. I'm already getting ready for Christmas. By the way, if you're listening to this, it's probably post-Christmas, but it is the 23rd today where we're recording this. So we're going to dive into these questions. So Carson, you ready?
Yeah. I figured since we haven't done a podcast in a little while, let's give Brandon a warm up. Just a nice softball question. When you're in a block, how do you get the motivation to study?
So what kind of block are you talking about? Are you talking about like block training?
I'd say a mental block. Like I just don't want to do it.
A mental block. I know. I think that this is kind of how a lot of people feel all the time, actually. I don't think it's just in wanting to study or not study. It's really a mental block on motivation. I think it stems from a lot of other things. Things that I use, I'll go work out lately. That's what I really like to do. I'll just go clear my mind. As much as Carson likes to joke about me going and taking naps all day, which I hardly ever do, naps sometimes actually help. As long as you take the right amount of naps, like 30 or 45 minutes, sometimes those actually help you get your brain reset.
Yeah, power nap.
Power nap, exactly. And there's actually something that I love to do, and it's this breathing exercise that I learned. And I don't know if it was like a Wim Hof method or somebody taught it to me, but there's this breathing exercise where you breathe in through your mouth and hold it for as long as you can. Then you exhale out of your nose, and then you cover up a nostril. You do the same thing. And then you cover up the other nostril and you do the same thing. And then you breathe through your mouth one last time and breathe out. And the whole exercise takes like 1 to 2 minutes. And you will feel so relaxed and ready to do whatever you need to do. It's unbelievable. So I like doing the breathing exercise a lot. It really helps. Outside of that, motivation to kind of get past a block, a mental block on maybe say flying. If you're working on something and you just cannot figure it out, every time you go and try and do slow flight, you just take all the flaps out every single time. I think that you really just need to take a step back, evaluate what you're doing, and kind of list it out in steps like a checklist, and then mentally go through that checklist or steps in your head. And even chair fly. I mean, you can literally sit in your chair and pretend that you're chair flying. I don't have the thing in this office, I don't think anymore. But in my old office, I actually used to have a panel of a 172, and they make them for Cherokees and they make them for Cirruses. And you could normally find a panel that is not necessarily identical to the one that you use, but pretty close. And what I'll do is I'll look at that poster. And I used to sit in front of the poster and I used to have it on my wall, like, and I would look at a wall. People would probably look at me if they saw me looking in there. What the heck is this guy doing? Right. And I would be looking at the wall and I would like be pretending I'm putting flaps to 10 and flaps to 15 or whatever it might be. Right. And I would literally chair fly that entire situation. So there's a few different ways, depending on what you meant by block, that I used to use and I still use in my daily habits and even when I'm learning to fly a new airplane or something like that.
Oh, thank you. Well, you came in a little hot this morning, so I think you should go do that breathing exercise and circle back. And
I already did it once this morning, Carson. I don't know what I'm going to do.
I don't know.
I think I'm in a good mood now, talking about airplanes.
Yeah, it usually gets you in a good mood. Yeah, I usually just take 1 or 2 minutes into the podcast and Brandon gets zoned in.
Airplane.
See, that's all I need. All right, second question. How do I handle motion sickness during initial flight lessons?
Ooh, that one's a special one.
That was a good one.
Bring a barf bag.
You know, every demo flight that happened at Next Gen, there would be a headset to borrow and a barf bag inside that headset, just in case.
Always. And then we would also have them stored in the airplane, just in case. Luckily, there weren't that many people who had to use them, to be honest.
I don't think I remember anyone using one.
Yeah, there were a few people.
Not when I was working, so.
Well, so this is pretty common, actually. I mean, it's not extremely common, but I'd say like 1 or 2. So 10 to 20% of people have this problem when they first start training. And I'll tell you, it goes away rather quickly. Most people have to deal with this for the first 1 to 5 lessons, and then it goes away like that. Like all of a sudden, it's just gone. And I don't know what changes per se. I'm not a doctor, but something changes for these students, and they no longer get sick. So I really tell everyone, keep your lessons shorter in the beginning. Make sure you don't do any like big maneuvers, and don't do any foggle stuff. That's for sure. By the way, foggles are view limiting devices, and they get the best of seasoned pilots sometimes and get you disoriented. They're really meant for you to get disoriented, not necessarily disoriented, but for you to know what it feels like if you do get disoriented and how to fix it by listening to your instruments or watching your instruments per se. So I would say just do everything a little bit slower. Take it easy. Tell your instructor, that's a big one. Tell your instructor that you're feeling sick, and either they're going to land immediately and get you on that ground, or tell that person that you just want to take it easy and you need to do nice, easy maneuvers. You don't need to do full stalls and let the nose fully drop, right? That's not really how you should be practicing a stall anyways, but it is nice to feel that and know what a full break will feel like, right? You know, I'm getting on a tangent here. Go ahead, Carson. What's the next question?
My 2 cents on this one. I think the biggest change comes when you actually start controlling the airplane and you're not just sitting there just getting jostled around. You don't know what movements are doing what, and you're just sitting there just, you know, shaking a little bit, light turbulence, some light chop. That's typically what I thought did it for me, because I actually had this problem. The first couple times I flew, I got kind of nauseous. And once I started taking control of the airplane, it was a whole different experience.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I mean, you can't go take
Dramamine
because FAA doesn't allow that. So I don't know if there's any other like non-prescription type of stuff. I think there is. Like there's like bracelets and stuff. I don't know if it's like voodoo magic or if it's real or not. But you can also do those ginger chews. I heard some people use the ginger chews.
Those are pretty good.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can try those things too.
Yeah.
But it all depends on you. You got to test it out yourself.
Yeah. So I would take those first couple flights and take them slow and figure out what works for you. That's the biggest thing. The next question is, how do you handle in-flight emergencies during training? I think for the sake of this question, just consider it's a student and a CFI together.
And it's a real emergency?
Yeah, I would say it's a real in-flight emergency.
If you are a student with an instructor, first off, student, give controls to said instructor. That's going to be number one. Let the instructor deal with it. You are not supposed to deal with this as a student. If it is a fake emergency, then the instructor will tell you what to do. So let's say it's a real emergency. Do you have a scenario that you would want me to kind of envision, Carson?
Yeah, let's do something dramatic. Engine fire.
Engine fire? Wow, you picked something very dramatic.
Yeah.
By the way, that is probably the least common thing that will happen for a in-flight emergency. All right, let's start with the engine fire. First off, let the instructor definitely deal with this. Instructor is going to work on putting that fire out, and they're going to do some pretty drastic things to put that fire out. The first thing is to turn off all the fuel, turn off the engine, might turn off electronics depending on what your POH says, but they're going to dive to put that engine fire out. So you're going to be going as fast as that airplane will go until that engine fire goes out, right? After that happens, they're going to get on the ground as quickly as possible without an engine. So it's going to turn into what a more normal emergency would be, which is an engine out, which I thought what you were going to say, Carson.
No, we're going dramatic, full scale.
Yeah, might as well, right? So this is a more likely thing that could happen, right? But it's still unlikely in the course of training that it will happen. I have had engine out scenarios, but I've only had them on multi-engine airplanes, knock on wood. Hope you heard that knock, knock, knock sound. And I would say, let the instructor handle it and let them put you in either get you to an airport or put you on the side of the road or something like that, right? You want to de-stress the situation. So don't start screaming and yelling, what are we going to do? Or we're going to die or something ridiculous like that. Because by the way, an engine out scenario is just like any other landing. I mean, before you land, you normally pull the engine to idle anyways. It's the same thing, except for you pulled the engine idle a little bit early. Just think about it as a non-emergency situation. And by the way, if you're afraid of stuff like this, I'm going to give you one big tip. You should go fly a glider. Go fly a glider, because every time you go land a glider, engine is out. There's no engine. It's fantastic. I was just talking to somebody on a meeting a few minutes ago about a new accounting software system we're looking at. And she actually told me that she soloed a glider. I don't know how old she was, but 14 or whatever it was. She soloed a glider as part of her private school, she said, capstone project. So she had to do that to like graduate, which was pretty cool. So, and I said, well, did it encourage you to learn to fly? She said, no, it didn't really encourage me to learn to fly, but it did encourage a whole bunch of her family to. So a whole bunch of her family members are now private pilots. And I guarantee they were less afraid of engine out scenarios. So there's my 5 cents on that one, Carson.
Yeah, I can't beat that one. Thank you. That was a pretty good one.
Thanks for picking fire, by the way. It's like the most terrifying thing you can have in an airplane.
Yeah, you can't spell Carson without arson. So I just naturally go straight to fire. It's just my name.
That is true. You know what time it is, Carson?
Time's a brain.
It's time to talk about one of our favorite companies.
Which company would that be?
Aviation Mentors is excited to be sponsored by the one and only Stratus Financial, dedicated to supporting the next generation of future aviators.
You know, Stratus Financial really understands the financial challenges that students face in pursuing their aviation dreams. That's why they offer student loans specifically tailored to aspiring pilots.
With competitive rates and flexible repayment plans, Stratus Financial helps take your aviation education to new heights.
So go visit their website today at www.stratus.finance. Just to be clear, that is not .com, it's .finance. And embark on your journey towards a sky full of possibilities.
Carson, it's time to get back to what we do best.
The show.
The show.
The next one is, how do you select the right aircraft for training?
Wow. So this one's another doozy for me, Carson. Thanks so much. As most answers that I like to answer are always vague and ambiguous, because I don't want to get sued. No, but the real thing is, and I won't get sued or anything over this type of answer, by the way, or called out by the FAA, which I'm more scared of than really a lawsuit. I would say that it depends on what you start out with. All the airplanes are good. They're all airplanes. They're all going to fly. They've got magic fairy dust that makes them take off and land and all this stuff, right? No, I'm just kidding.
Straight from my CFI's mouth, ladies and gentlemen.
Magic fairy dust makes it fly.
Yeah, I'd love that.
Exactly. No, so I mean, it really doesn't matter. There's people that learn to fly in a J3 Cub with no electrical system, right? That's how people did it for many, many years. That's a tailwheel aircraft. There's people like me that learned to fly in a Cessna 172. Carson, I think you learned in a 172, but then you learned to start flying in a Cherokee, right? There's some people that fly in a Tectum, which is a really great technologically advanced airplane to learn into nowadays, right? Same thing with some of the new Cessnas, the new Pipers. A Cirrus can be a great airplane to go learn to fly in, although a little bit more challenging. But depends on what your mission's going to be. I would say go learn to fly in the airplane that you're going to go want to fly long term. And maybe you don't know what that is. By the way, if you want to go fly for yourself and you just want like a 4-person plane and you want to go fly different places and you plan on buying a Cirrus at the end of the day, go learn in a Cirrus. If you plan on learning to fly for a career, go fly in a plane that you know is plentiful around you that you can go rent pretty easily. For me, that was a 172. And then I learned to fly in a Piper Cherokee. It also depends on kind of what you prefer. Do you want to be able to see things when you lift the wing or lower the wing? And that matters if you like high wings or low wings a little bit better as well. Honestly, there's no real way to tell you what you're going to like best until you go test them out.
And there's nothing wrong with taking a lesson or two in different planes and seeing what you like, what you fit well into.
Oh, that's a big one. I didn't even think about that. What do you fit into? I know if you're 6'5", you're not going to fit into any airplane except for a Piper Tomahawk, which we've talked about before.
Yeah. I mean, things just, that changed a lot. And there's nothing wrong with taking a couple lessons to make sure you're going to be comfortable and what you're going to plan on training in for a while.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Fully agree with Carson for once. I can't even believe this.
Mark, I want the clip of that. Thank you. All right, Brandon, last question for today. And this one I don't think is a doozy. I think you have some good advice on this one. How do you handle air traffic control communications in a busy airspace?
I'm going to take this in a whole bunch of different ways, actually. So busy airspace just means there's a lot of people talking, right? It doesn't necessarily mean a lot of people are talking to you. So I think that most people get overwhelmed with busy airspace because they're hearing all of this chatter on the radio. They should not be consumed by that. And it's really hard. I mean, as men, A lot of women say that we have selective hearing, and probably it's true. And as pilots, we need to have selective hearing, by the way. We need truly to only listen for our tail number. And it's really kind of hard to actually master, because when you're listening to the radios, you're listening to everything. And when people are becoming a pilot for the first time, I know I've always encouraged my students to go listen to ATC and go listen to see what people are going on. Now, when you start listening to that, it actually ingrains one thing that's negative. So I'm starting to think back on that and try to reason with myself to see if it's actually correct or not. And the reason behind that is when you start to learn listening to ATC, there's no different when you're in the plane. So I'm still going to encourage people to do that, actually. But when you're listening to ATC, you're listening to everybody. Like when you're practicing, you're just listening to what radio calls sound like. But when you're flying your airplane, you only need to listen to what radio calls you need to hear. So if you say November 7320 Juliet, and that's your tail number, those are the only things you should be listening for. Literally, that's all. You should not care about any of the other stuff. Now, as you get to become a better pilot and you get to listen to those radios a little bit more, you might actually be able to hear other radio calls for other airplanes that might affect you. So if you know that somebody is around you and you know that's their airplane, now you can figure out, okay, they're descending, they're behind me, I know just to kind of look out for them. But that's something that you don't really have to learn to be conscious of until you really understand listening to ATC's directions, right? You just need to have your head on that swivel, looking back and forth, looking up and down, left and right for other airplanes out there, and listening for your tail number when ATC's calling. Back to your original question on why this matters is if you're in a busy airspace, you're going to hear chatter constantly. If you're trying to comprehend every single bit of that chatter, it's going to be a big heartache for you. So what you need to do is focus on you, focus on what airplanes are around you, up, down, left, right, like I said, and then also just focus on your call signs. Otherwise, you're going to get so overwhelmed, it's going to be unbelievable. And this is also the reason why student pilots get so fatigued after their first cross-country flight, with or without an instructor. And it's because they're not just listening for their own call sign. They're actually listening for everybody's call signs, which makes it very difficult. Now, you may also notice if you're a student, flight instructors are able to communicate with you, communicate with ATC, and still teach you all at the same time. It's because of that selective hearing. They're literally tuning themselves out to everything except for their call signs. That's the way flight instructors make it happen.
And aside from that, you usually know as a especially when you're really familiar with an area, usually you know when ATC is going to contact you. So you have a rough idea of when to listen, especially.
That comes, though, after you've been a pilot for a long time.
That does.
I mean, you're not going to know that with 20 hours. I mean, like whenever I would leave Riverside and go to Long Beach or John Wayne, I know there's an exact point where they give me 121.3. And I know that when I try to call them at 121.3 at that exact time, I won't be able to reach the next controller because the mountains are in the way at 3,500 feet. And I know that every single time. And it's actually right over Carson's house where that happens almost. And I know that because I've flown that route 50 times. Most people don't know that until they've done that a whole bunch of times. So really, I'm still going to stick to my guns. Listen for your own call sign.
All right, I have a bonus question. Something that really freaked me out was actually knowing when to jump in, because there was so much happening. Like I was never confident enough to know when I could start talking. How do you really overcome that and know when a good time is to just jump in there and start trying to talk to ATC?
After ATC communicates, they're expecting a pilot to communicate back. Right? So as soon as the pilot communicates back to ATC and that ends that conversation, that's when you should step in immediately. Now, there's a caveat. If the pilot says something back and says they're requesting additional information back from ATC, so that's going to require ATC to respond back, and then you will know the pilot will have to respond back. So no matter what, it's after the pilot responds is when you want to do it. And also, if you're getting on to a new frequency, don't just click the mic and start talking. Give it like 1 to 2 seconds so you don't step on somebody, right?
Yeah.
There's your bonus answer, Carson, for the bonus question.
Thank you, Brian. I really appreciate that.
Anytime. I try to do my best.
We love doing these. Answering these questions are a lot of fun for us. And it's a lot of fun for me to hassle Brian over the answers. So thank you. And please don't stop asking these questions, especially as a student pilot. You should never stop asking questions. No pilot should ever stop. There's always more to be learned. And even someone like Brian has something to teach you.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's weird, huh? So, well, thank you so much for listening to us today. This is part one of a multi-part series, so you will hear more questions coming up soon on next week's episode. So thank you so much for joining us. If you'd like to reach out to either one of us, you can always reach us on our emails, Brandon@aviationmentors.com or Carson@aviationmentors.com. Don't forget to hit follow, like, share, and make sure you stream us on whatever platform you're listening to us on, or better yet, on YouTube, watching us on, and make sure you click that subscribe button below, please. It's really a huge part of helping the podcast grow and really helping us grow the aviation community as a whole. So thank you so much for listening today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, everybody. And as we wrap up for the day, remember, we're here to guide you in your aviation journey. So fly safe and enjoy the ride.